is he, my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. It's another Monday evening. We're taking a little bit of a unique turn this evening. Christmas is just around the corner, and this is a very popular time of year for parents especially, but sometimes lovers as well, to purchase pets for those that they love. And there's a lot of things that one needs to consider before you make a move like that. Not the least of which is where that pet has actually derived from and how it got to be in your world at this point. I'm sure there's other things we need to consider too. But right now I'm welcoming Dr. Franklin McMillan to the show. He's actually the Director of Well-Being Studies at Best Friends Animal Society, which is located in Utah. I've been actually a longtime fan and supporter of Best Friends Society. They are the largest no-kill facility in the United States. Dr. Franklin McMillan, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Veronica.
I understand you're doing some really fascinating research. You just completed a study which was looking into the psychological and emotional effects of being in a puppy mill on dogs. And I understand you're also working on a study about the Great Kitty Rescue in Nevada.
Yep.
Also the fighting dogs that were recovered from the estate of former NFL quarterback Michael Vick.
Actually not former, he's currently back in.
You know, I'm not much of a football fan, but I thought he had been reinstated.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Anyway, so, yes, we're doing those and more. Yeah.
And you've got a book, which is called "Unlocking the Animal Mind: How Your Pet's Feelings Hold the Key to His Health and Happiness."
Yep.
Is that available on Amazon?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. You know, before we go into the psychological profile of dogs that have been raised in puppy mills, what kind of obstacles have you encountered getting your colleagues to even entertain the idea that we should be studying the psychology of pets?
Boy, that's a great question. It's not been extremely difficult, although it's been somewhat, and let me explain that. The issue of emotional suffering and psychological trauma is being more and more accepted nowadays. I write a lot and speak a lot, and there's not much resistance to having me come and talk to veterinary groups and things like that. But the part where it is a little bit not accepted, and this follows the path of human medicine, is the interaction of emotions and physical health. This is something that you, and I'm sure your audience is well aware of, that, of course, emotions have a strong impact on physical health. And when I started writing about that and, volunteering to speak at conferences, they kind of wanted me, but they weren't sure where to classify me because it didn't fit in the solid medicine or the solid behavior. And so that was a bit of a challenge, which is still kind of going on. It's hard to break through in human medicine and veterinary medicine with these concepts that seem so touchy-feely and nebulous, like emotions, when everybody wants the hard science. It's just, it's a tough mix right now, even though, of course, it's heading in that direction.
There's a lot of scientists who still avoid asserting that animals have feelings. Instead, they usually reference the behavior of the animal in all their research.
That's true. And we get that a lot when we're trying to write these kinds of articles about psychological trauma. But the evidence is so overwhelming now. And in fact, of course, they wouldn't be doing that ugly kind of research on animals to test for drugs and anti-anxiety, antidepressants, if the animals didn't have those kinds of responses. So to talk about strict behavior is kind of ridiculous when they're actually certifying and approving drugs on the basis of how they are helping those animals.
It is utterly amazing to me, it really, because a lot of times the argument goes, well, we can't make that extrapolation because humans and animals are not at all similar, but yet we can do research on them because humans and animals are so similar.
it's a classic dilemma that they have. The scientists that do that kind of research, that of course we don't approve of, but that do the testing, they have to maintain both stances, that they're very much like us, but they're not at all like us. And which one is it?
You know? I know. You pick a side, please.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, too, of course, is I'm reminded of, I don't know if you're familiar with a leading primatologist by the name of Franz de Waal.
Oh, very well, yes.
Okay. You probably even met him. Who knows? I love, because the big bugaboo is that we're not supposed to be guilty of anthropomorphizing, which I've always thought was, it's interesting we have to have a separate term, because if I am projecting my psychological landscape on you, it's projection. It's a very simple psychological term. But if I do that to an animal, now all of a sudden it's anthropomorphizing. And I loved Franz de Waal's term, is like, if I see two apes engaging in politics and I want to ignore that, I think I'm guilty of anthropo-denial.
Yep, he coined that term, and it's so true, because there's, in the scientific community, there's so much resistance to implying that they have feelings like us, that that his term, anthropo-denial, is basically what a lot of the scientists are still in.
Yes, I agree, and I think about, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
Oh, yeah.
And Rupert Sheldrake, it was like, in a lot of ways, he's been kind of, I don't know, but it's my understanding he's been drummed out of some scientific circles because of the, trying to quantify something. He's been able to, duplicate his research over and over again. He's used double-blind studies, but because he doesn't know what the mechanism is behind the phenomena, then all of a sudden he's not being a scientist.
Yeah, I know. Oh. And it gets into those areas that scientists are very uncomfortable with, and that is, that's even beyond just straight feelings. That's perceptions that we can't even understand ourselves in terms of how would a dog know from afar that their owners are doing this, that, or the other? We don't know, and it's bizarre.
I know, but, I think about, if you go back to, there must have been somebody who was washing their hands during the bubonic plague and had no idea why it was working.
Right.
Because we didn't have a microscope yet, and we didn't know there was such a thing as germs.
Well, In the Civil War, the doctors, they actually wanted to wear bloody gowns in when they visited patients. That was like a show of status, that they were, sort of working in the blood. And, of course, now we know that's exactly how you transmit the diseases.
Bloodborne diseases.
Yeah, exactly.
Unbelievable. Well, so what kind of methodology did you use with your most recent study about dogs that come from puppy mills?
Well, just to clarify to all your listeners, there's two types of dogs involved with puppy mills. And puppy mills, if They aren't sure, are these large breeding facilities with hundreds, sometimes even thousands of dogs that are just kept cooped in cages and producing puppies, which are then trucked off to all the pet stores. And so the two groups of dogs are the ones that are stuck in the puppy mill producing the puppies. Those are the adult breeding dogs. And then, of course, there's the puppies, and those are the ones you get if you buy from a pet store, which, of course, we advocate not doing. And what we actually have done a study on each one. The one that we just published was on the ones that are the breeding dogs that have been cooped up for years in cages, and then they get out, and there's a number of ways they can get out. Either the puppy mill can be busted because of legal violations, or they just close down, go out of business. One way or another, some of these dogs are lucky enough to get out and be adopted through rescue groups. And we were seeing some behavioral abnormalities, so we decided, myself and I teamed up with a couple of colleagues of mine at University of Pennsylvania, we decided to study the psychological makeup. And the way we did it was we solicited people who had adopted these dogs, and that was done through all the rescue groups that adopt these dogs out. And then we asked if they would participate in an online questionnaire, and it's 101 questions. It's a pretty extensive psychological analysis, if you will, of their dog. And then, of course, we compared that with a control group. Those are dogs that, of course, have never been in a puppy mill. They're just normal pet dogs. And then we were able to see how different these dogs are, and not only how different they are, but how long-lasting the effects are, because, of course, some of the dogs in our study have been in their homes already for 6-7 years. Others just, you know, arrived maybe 6 months ago. But we could tell that these effects, and most of them were related to fear, which is kind of understandable, were long-lasting and very extensive. And the other thing, along the lines of how much effect there is, I should point out that just like people, soldiers that come back from warfare, some are completely fine with no after effects, and others, of course, are devastated, and then there's every in-between, and that's what we found. It's not like every dog coming out is psychologically harmed. It's that a lot of them are, and as a group, they show a distinct difference between normal pet dogs and these dogs coming out.
Wow. And if, what about the puppies that are birthed there? Do they spend enough time in the puppy mill for it to have a negative effect on them, or are they basically okay?
Well, you know, that's a great question the way you ask it, because I was in private practice as a veterinarian for 26 years, and I thought pretty much my entire career that puppies from puppy mills got out of there so fast, there's really not much harm that could be done. Well, not only have I studied them and proved myself quite wrong, but all the research now of other animals shows how extensive the harm can be even in that short period. And just to give you an example, there's tons of research now both in animals and in people, for that matter, that show that a pregnant woman or animal, female, of course, carrying a fetus or more, if that female goes through stress, it imparts changes on the developing brain of the fetus and will show those effects oftentimes for the entire life. For people, those kids that were born, that were pregnant at the time, whether it be 9/11 or earthquakes, that kind of a thing, will have a much higher incidence of mental illness throughout life, social relationship problems, and we see that in animals too. So even though these puppies get out kind of early, they've actually been traumatized in utero when they were in their mother, and then they, even if they left the minute they were born, which they don't, they still have after effects. But then they spend another 8 weeks in the puppy mill and then come out and are sold through pet stores. So there, it turns out that there's a lot of time that they can show, or they can undergo damage. And that's exactly what the study showed that we just finished, and that is how do pet store dogs compare to normal breeder dogs when they grow up to be adults, and we found significant abnormalities in the pet store dogs.
Unbelievable. That's actually a shocking piece of information as far as human birth, too. It kind of harks back to the old wives' tale, or what we thought was an old wives' tale, where women were admonished to be very careful about what kind of environment they were in during their pregnancy. It's kind of scary, actually, to think about.
And they've done it over and over and over. There was a big earthquake in China in 1976. There was an ice storm in Toronto, Canada. All of these, there were a lot of pregnant women. And what they did is they studied the children born to these women, the ones that were pregnant at the time of the stress. And again, I mentioned the 9/11. Those reports just started coming out. They compared them with women that were pregnant around that time, but not during the actual stressful period. So the children were pretty well matched in terms of age as they grow up. But the emotional impact of being stressed during pregnancy on the child is huge.
Wow. So it's just amazing. The more we delve, the more we find we're all so very connected. And interdependent. What are some of the things? I definitely want to find out what happens to the breeding parents that are in the puppy mill. But for the purposes of this time of year, where people are thinking about actually purchasing a puppy that might be at Petco or something like that, what are some of the things that a puppy that was raised in a puppy mill would? What kind of behaviors would they elicit?
What we found, now we're talking about the puppies now,
we're talking about the puppies.
Yeah, the puppies are the ones that at this time of year we do want to talk about, because we don't want to have people go to pet stores and buy these puppies. But what they showed is a much higher incidence of fear, and this is fear of many different things in life, sounds, people, other dogs, that kind of a thing. But the other thing we found, and this was actually more dramatic, is the aggression level registers much higher in dogs that are purchased as puppies from pet stores than they do if they're purchased from puppies from private breeders, the small breeders. Mm-hmm. And this is aggression towards other dogs, towards people, and most dramatically towards the very owner that takes the puppy home. It turns out that if you purchase a puppy through a pet store, your chance of being bit by that dog is 7 times higher than it would be if you bought it from a private breeder.
Now,
if you neuter the dog, it goes down, but it's still 3 times as high.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's really something that is important for us to know and share, because we knew that puppies coming from the large breeding facilities, the puppy mills, were not doing as well behaviorally, psychologically, and even physically, but we just didn't know how to quantify it or exactly explain it, and now we do.
My Lord, 3 to 7 times as likely to be bit. And so if you're wanting to make this purchase for your child, especially, this is something you don't want to encounter as a dangerous dog.
And again, they're not all aggressive. I wouldn't want to say that. It's just, again, playing the odds. If you had one from a private breeder or pet store, that's your difference.
So what about the listeners who may be thinking, okay, but I'm going to go down to my big pet store and I'm going to ask them if the puppy came from a puppy mill, and they're probably going to tell me, no, these puppies are great. And so, I'm sure that they don't...
Well, I guarantee you they'll tell them no, and that's for many reasons. Sometimes they don't know because you're talking to just one of the staff members. Other times they're defining puppy mill different than you are. We define it as any large-scale breeding facility turning out puppies for profit. It doesn't matter if they're dirty and grungy, the kind you see on Oprah, or if they're sparkly clean. The dogs are still very deprived emotionally of any human companionship or any toys. They've never seen a toy in their life, and they don't get out of their cages, and they're in these tiny little cages. So what the pet store owner might say is, no, we buy from reputable breeders. They're USDA licensed and inspected, and all of that is meaningless. All the licensing and inspecting is based on regulations that the bar is set so low that that the dog, that the breeder, meeting every requirement and passing inspection, still can be traumatizing the dogs. Unknowingly, it's not like nobody's trying to hurt the dogs, but by keeping them in this kind of a confinement. Basically, I should point out, conceptually, we're talking about the identical thing as we are with egg farms, meaning that, of course, the mothers and the breeders are kept in cages for their entire life. They turn out a product, goes off to market. The only difference is in one case it's eggs, and the other case it's puppies.
And what happens to these breeding dogs once they are no longer a viable producer of puppies?
Well, there's a number of outcomes. The breeders that have a bit of a heart try to sell these dogs or even give them to rescue groups. They're not all mean people. They're not. In fact, some of them just aren't aware that dogs have certain needs that they're not meeting. But they do. They'll often give them away, and rescue groups will often go to these dog auctions, which are literally livestock auctions where they auction dogs from one puppy mill breeder to another. But a lot of rescue groups now go to these and bid for the dogs to buy them out of the hands of the puppy mill people. So there's a lot of ways they eventually do get out of the puppy mill, but not always. The ones that don't, and that have just run their course, unfortunately, are either euthanized humanely or taken out back and shot. They're just not to put up with. I mean, they just don't need the dogs anymore after they don't breed. So unless they're the kind-hearted that do get sell them off or give them away, the deaths are, not pleasant.
Unbelievable. So would you say that these large-scale breeding facilities, if it's really about the profit, so it's not about the animal's welfare, and the idea that all an animal needs is clean drinking water and food and hopefully not to be standing in their own feces and urine, how do I get people past that where they start realizing that these are sentient beings that have emotional needs? And what are those emotional needs? How can we quantify that?
We can't quantify them. That's what I've been working on a lot, and it's just very hard to quantify a dog's emotional needs for human companionship. But the most important needs for the dog, beyond the obvious, and you just listed them, the water and food, are adequate space to obviously move around and exercise. But far, far more importantly, dogs through domestication have been bred to have a very, very strong need for human companionship. That's what makes them man's best friend, but it also makes them suffer more when they don't get it. And so human companionship in a pleasant, positive way, not human companionship that somebody comes by and, throws food in their cage. But gentle, caring human companionship is a very important need for a dog. And in fact, the studies that have compared the need for dog companionship or human companionship, meaning that if they test a dog on their preference of being given a human companion or a dog companion, the choice is always the human. And that's even with dogs that have been housed together for years. They'll still choose a human over another dog. And you can't give a dog companion and replace that need for humans. They're two different needs, and it's just that through domestication, the need for human companionship has become so strong, and that's why the dogs that are chained out in the backyard, they're howling because they're just starved for human companionship, and it's just terribly sad.
I live up in the forest, and one of my neighbors, who lives quite a distance away, probably 2 miles away, has a beautiful boxer who they're gone. They both work, and so they're gone, and he's home alone. And thank God they don't chain him, but then on the other hand, that's not great because he's traversing roads that have very little traffic up here, but it's still a risk and a danger to his safety, in my opinion. But he will run all over the forest free, doing whatever he wants, and what he wants is to get inside my fenced yard.
Yeah.
And he stands out there and wants me to let him in. Because, you know, he has all the freedom in the world. He can do anything he wants, go anywhere he wants. And what he wants is to be with people, and also he really likes my dog. But
yeah.
It's just, I'm sure you're familiar with Temple Grandin. I liked her book very much. Let's see, Animals in Translation. She talks a little...
She actually contributed a chapter to my textbook on mental health and animals, so
oh,
I know her quite
did.
Well.
Yeah. She did. I just adore her because, of course, you know, she's able to relate to an animal perspective a little more than some people. And for our listeners who don't know about Temple Grandin, she's a PhD who's authored quite a few books, but she's autistic. So she tends to see the world more in pictures, which some theories are that may be a little more close to how an animal would see the world, since they don't necessarily have words. And I loved one theory that she was forwarding, which was, and maybe it's not a theory, maybe you can clear this up for me, but she was saying that most domestic animals lose about 10% of their brain mass. And that's happened in the horse, it's happened in the cow, it's happened in the dog. Interestingly enough, about the same time that human beings start burying themselves with their dogs, the human brain lost 10% of its mass as well.
Ooh.
And I thought that was very interesting because it kind of speaks to the whole idea of who domesticated whom.
Yeah, that's true. It does seem that domestication actually worked jointly, especially in dogs, that we sort of co-evolved. It wasn't like we domesticated them and we were unaffected by it.
No. No, it's like it's almost like we picked each other, or I kind of sometimes fantasize that the wolves picked us. But
no, well, it's not a fantasy. That's one of the theories. Is that in fact all the theorizing is about who picked who and who approached who, and it does appear to be mutual. But you know, some people argue more the wolf approached us than vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a beautiful relationship, but I'm a dog lover. Can you tell us a little bit about Michael Vick's dogs?
Sure.
I know the listeners are probably very, you know, curious what's happened to them. Where are they?
Yeah, well, there were 49 rescued, and I should say 22 of them, the groups that were managing them up at first, right after the rescue, considered these 22 to be the worst of the worst. And I don't mean worst judgmentally. I mean worst in the sense of least likely to be rehabilitated and eventually find a home. And so those are the ones that we flew out and did our assessments of them and then had them flown into Utah to our sanctuary. And so of those 22, two of them were court-ordered to stay with us for their whole life because they had shown some aggression. Both of them are sweethearts, and we will appeal that decision after they've shown a little bit more stability, which they already have. We just want it to last a little longer. But of the other ones, what we did is we put them on a specific individualized program to help them with whatever troubles they were having, and the troubles were quite different. There were some that were absolutely terrified of everything and would just flatten to the ground, not even walk on a leash. Others were perfectly fine around other dogs, but fearful when people would walk into their enclosure. So we set up programs to work with each one of them individually, and I was the one who did the studies of their psychological recovery and created all these charts and graphs showing the lines going exactly the way we wanted to and in almost all of them. And what I mean by that is fear levels over time diminished in 18 out of them. And all the other values we wanted to go up, meaning just general enjoyment of life, how they perceive things, confidence level, energy level, all that kind of thing. And so we could actually see, not only just obviously by looking at them, but scientifically, that they improved over time. And so what's happened since then is that we still have a few of them at the sanctuary, but others are either fostered into foster homes or adopted into homes, and many of them are living very compatibly with other dogs. Of course, we didn't know a lot about rescued fighting dogs because up until the Michael Vick case, they were almost always killed after the court trial of the people that they were rescued from, which was, of course, terribly sad and what we argued against, and the judge did allow the Michael Vick dogs to live. So now we can see what a fairly large number of these dogs do, and it's been remarkable. One of the dogs didn't come to us, his name's Leo, he became a certified therapy dog, and a lot of other different avenues that these dogs took. And in fact, there's a great book written by a Sports Illustrated writer, Jim Garant, called The Lost Dogs. And he actually has the story of every one of the Michael Vick dogs, including not just ours, but the ones that went elsewhere. And it's a great book. And if anybody really wants to hear the stories of these dogs and their recovery, that's just, you can't beat that book. It's called The Lost Dogs.
The Lost Dogs. And one of them actually is a certified therapy dog.
Yeah, Leah. And he was... He was one of the group that was very, very easygoing right up front. Those were the ones, of course, that were easy to place into rescue groups and quickly into homes. We had the more challenging ones that obviously weren't going to be adopted immediately, needed quite a bit of therapy. But the recovery's been great. And in fact, when we took them in, we took in 22, and at the time, nobody knew on former fighting dogs what kind of recovery there would be, in the sense of, you know, we knew it wasn't 100% that would bounce right back into, you know, a personal pet ownership situation. But we got up where we are about 16 or 17 of them are either adoptable, adopted, or near adoptable, and just a few of them, which is no surprise, we would expect some of them, just like people going through trauma, to have more ongoing problems. But,
sure.
But nothing bad. That's the nice thing is none of them have been psychologically so traumatized that they can't even function or enjoy life at all. Some, of course, have ongoing issues, but still able to enjoy life largely, almost all the time.
Well, congratulations, and that that bodes well for, you know. Unfortunately, there are still people that are fighting dogs, so in future rescue cases, that bodes well for those dogs that they won't have to be euthanized.
And I should point out one thing that, just to clarify for your listeners. There's the types of aggression that people worry about with pit bulls is really misplaced. And what I mean by that is that pit bulls over several hundred years have actually been bred to be very, very affectionate with people. About 100 years ago, they were the family dog. That's why Little Rascals had Petey, and they were the family dog. And so their general demeanor around people is actually, across the board, very, very good, of course, with exceptions, but every breed has their exceptions.
Yeah.
So it's not like pit bulls, and even the fighting ones, which everybody worries, oh my God, and they, you know, they're going to cause problems. No, they're very, very loving dogs, and in fact, the fact that they bond with people is actually used against them to make them fight harder, because they're so trying to please their owner and get the affection that they'll keep fighting in the pit, even when they're, like, terribly exhausted.
So it's actually a sign of their loyalty, then.
Exactly, right.
I have never purchased from a pet store, but I did purchase a couple of purebred German Shepherds who have since passed on, and I've resolved never to purchase again. I want a rescue, and so the dog that I have right now is a little rescue mix, and She definitely was abused before she came to me. She didn't know how to catch a ball. She thought that it was something she had to duck and hide and run from.
No, yeah.
And so it's been for me an incredibly rewarding journey to rehabilitate her, to build her confidence, to just watch her blossom in ways that are so beautiful. And,
go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking about the listeners who might be saying, oh, well, I bought from a pet store, and yes, my dog is fearful and distant and showing compulsive behaviors, but how can I solve that? How can I fix that?
Well, right now, the way we address them is just we take them individually. If they're fearful, for example, of a specific thing, there are ways to desensitize and counter-condition. People can contact me, but there's lots and lots of sources to help with fearful dogs. Compulsive behaviors, luckily we don't see too many of them. And some of them are quite correctable by redirecting the dog's attention, but others, just like the people, are a little more stubborn and resistant to various types of therapy. And there's all the way up to drug therapy for certain things like that, too. So there's no one answer for your question, but all I can say is there's lots of things that are now available, and including natural remedies, the non-medicine type of things like pheromones and even lavender essence. Some of these things are actually scientifically proven to have anti-anxiety effects and help a lot of dogs.
And what do you think about acupuncture? Because I had a dog that had some anxiety, and I took him for acupuncture treatments. It seemed to help. But
well, one of my colleagues at the animal hospital I worked at in Los Angeles, she and I worked together for 18 years, and she was an acupuncturist. And I saw a lot of animals that she took care of that showed improvement. So it seems to have a lot of benefits. It's hard for them to be quantified because, unfortunately, with acupuncture, you can't run a control study of pins that don't cause an effect compared to the ones that do. But anyway, yeah, long story short is that a lot of things that can respond to acupuncture.
So don't despair. Get professional help. And
And
are you at all a fan of Cesar Millan and some of his training techniques? Or?
Well, some of the techniques. Unfortunately, a lot of what he emphasizes with domination and alpha roles are now proven scientifically to have no basis and can cause harm. It's one of these things where you don't want to put another trainer or behavior person down, but you just have different techniques that you use yourself.
Okay. Is there a particular resource that you would direct the listeners to if they're having behavioral problems with their pets so that they don't give up and take them to the pound but just get help?
There's lots. The one that I like the best because it covers the most ground because most problems in dogs, including aggression, are fear-based, is a book by Nicole Wild called Help for Your Fearful Dog. And it's so, so good because it covers all types of fears, all the desensitization, counter-conditioning, I can't recommend it highly enough. She just did a wonderful job. That's the best resource I can give. Obviously, there's many, many more for specific problems, that's a good one.
And then let's talk a little bit about the activism for people who don't want to perpetuate puppy mills. How can they make better decisions when acquiring a pet?
Well, there's a number of ways to do it. One, of course, is to not purchase from pet stores and tell everybody you know the same thing. The other, though, is what do you do then if you want a pet? Because we know at Best Friends and any welfare agency knows that people do want purebred dogs. It's not like everybody will be happy to go to a shelter and rescue a mixed breed, although we wish they would. Yeah. But first of all, there's a lot of purebreds at shelters. That's the first place to go. The second best place is the breed rescues. There are rescue groups for every breed that the AKC registers and more. So you can get your purebred that way, and even those are even better because you know the personality when you're getting them.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, would be the private breeders that breed in very small numbers, like one or two females in their home, giving the puppies and the mothers and fathers of the dogs very, very good lives and socialization and fun and games. And those are the breeders that you can only know by going and seeing them and meeting them, and you'll know they're a good breeder if they interview you because they want to know their puppies are going to a good place. They also want you to assure them that if it doesn't work out, you'll return the puppy to them, which, of course, distinguishes them from breeders that are doing it strictly for money in large volumes, shipping them by air cargo from Missouri. You just don't buy your dogs that way. So private breeders where you can go and visit and you get grilled, too, that's when you know things are going the way you want them to.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I know when I purchased the first German Shepherd came from a family friend. So it was, you know, a best friend's daughter that was raising them. And that was the only time she ever raised puppies was just this one litter. So that was, you know, a beautiful, beautiful experience. But the second time I went to a breeder, and it was a private home. It was just one breeding pair. They had really nice home with lots of acres and everything. But I still got the feeling that they might be allowing the mother to have too many litters. She just was looking a bit gaunt to me.
Yeah.
So are there things that people could look for in that way?
No, because you're not going to actually, I mean, even me as a vet, I'm not going to be able to just look at the dog and know that everything is perfectly fine or not. I guess the best way to do it is you're going to have to take the word of or certain words of people, you know, on faith. And when you're in a place where clearly they're loving inside the home and the person tells you we only breed the female once a year as opposed to twice a year the way the puppy mills do, they're likely telling you the truth because you wouldn't be in their home being interviewed if that weren't the case.
Okay.
And that's what respectable breeders do, is they do allow rest periods. They don't overstress their females. You can pretty much count on it that way.
Okay. And what about best friends? If somebody is listening and wanting to actually just come to best friends, you have animals for adoption, yes?
Oh, yeah, to put it mildly. Yeah, they're all on our website. People can, of course, look at them that way. But, yeah, we love people to come and visit, and we also depend heavily on people that come and volunteer. And these are people that end up walking the dogs, socializing them, or working with the cats. Our pig department is one of the most popular. People really love coming and working with the pigs. But we have horses and rabbits, and it's just a great place. A lot of people spend their vacation every year with us, and it's just a great experience because you just feel so good. You're helping the animals.
Absolutely. And for the listeners, the website is bestfriends.org. That's bestfriends.org. And go over there and sign up for the newsletter. It's great stories about animal rescues, things that really I think are just heartwarming and encouraging. One of the things that I love about Best Friends' approach is that it's so hopeful and so positive. Sometimes some of the other animal rights organizations that I have supported over the years, it can be pretty depressing. And it's like you're getting this dose of bad news all the time. And Best Friends is dealing with bad news, but you are always, you know, transmuting that into something positive.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I didn't even know that when I came here to Best Friends 4 years ago, and I didn't even know that myself. But it's a very, very diligent effort on our part to make people feel good about things that are going on. And even my studies, which turn up not so pleasant things, we try to put it out in a positive way that with this knowledge we can help dogs' lives. rather than dwell on the horrors of puppy mills. It's just that now that we know and how to help the animals, we can do so much more for them.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, for the listeners who are planning on getting a pet or already have a pet, do you have kind of a checklist on how to go beyond just putting, you know, fabulous food and a clean environment for your dog? How, if you have a dog specifically, since we're talking about dogs mostly tonight, what are the emotional needs of a dog? How does one make sure that you are supplying those?
Well, the key is obviously when you get a dog to know that dogs do have a strong need for human companionship. They don't have to be with a person 24 hours a day, but you don't want to get the dog and leave them at home 12 hours alone every day. Even with even if they have a dog companion, they still need your presence. So obviously get a dog that's suited or get a dog with your lifestyle in mind. And if you are getting a dog and not allowing yourself enough time, then make other arrangements in terms of having pet sitters come in, take them to doggy daycare, of all these other things. But you just want to make sure that you give them plenty of interaction with people, since that's what dogs are, is basically people magnets. And so you want to give them all that. The other emotional needs come down strictly to engaging the mind, meaning that their need for mental stimulation is not far off ours, in the sense that they don't want to be bored. Boredom is something that is very, very unpleasant. We tend to make light of it because we can get rid of it so easy. But when you leave a dog with nothing to do all day, that's tormenting. I mean, that's just really unpleasant. And so to be able to engage their mind with interactive toys if you are gone, and of course lots of play and interaction when you are home, you just want to give them a good life. You don't want them just to be an ornament in your house and, expect them to make themselves happy. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And I think it's just one of the things that I've learned from tonight's interview is just how much dogs crave people. There have been some people who have kind of said, oh, dogs would rather be with other dogs. And I've noticed this when I go to the dog park with my dog. I tell her, go play with the other dogs. I'll be right here, and she'll be like, no, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, and it's important to point out that all, whether you're talking about different individual dogs or breeds, there are different levels of need for human companionship. It's not like everyone will be starved if you're out of your house for an hour. It's just that you want to be able to recognize that they have a need and then try your best to meet that need, whether it is a strong need or a mild need. But they all have the need. It's just a very different level.
Hmm. Well, you had mentioned something about people being able to contact you. How would they contact you and for what purpose?
Well, for any purpose that they want, but my email for
those. Well, I'm trying to make sure you don't just get bombarded with a whole bunch of, my dog's spinning. What do I do?
I know. Well, yeah. Well, my email address is dr.frank, that's dr.frank, at bestfriends.org. And I can, probably the most value, rather than me, of course, consulting on a zillion behavior problems myself, is be able to direct people to the best resources for individual problems, because there's so many resources to turn to these days. Some of them would cost money. Others are freebies. There are some groups, ASPCA and Denver Dumb Friends League, that offer behavior counseling free over the phone and over the Internet. So there's a lot of resources for people with problems, and don't give up on pets that are having problems, because, they rely on you to help them out. And, some of these things require effort, others not so much, but it's definitely worth looking into.
Absolutely, and it's been my experience that if you'll take that journey with your animal companion, you'll wind up a better person. So it's like a learning growth experience that the two of you get to share.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So it doesn't always have to be just I'm trying to help this animal. It's let the animal help you.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say a lot of people do raise the question of who rescued who when they rescued an animal.
Oh, so many times I tell my little Amelie, I go, thank you for picking me, and
right.
thank you for all that she's taught me, because I have learned so much from every single dog I've ever had.
Oh, yeah. They're all individual.
They are, and I'm not the same person. If I had never had a dog in my life, I'd be somebody else. But you're doing a lot of studies about cats now. Looking towards the future here, you're working with cats.
Yeah, I've just finished a study on 79 of the cats that were rescued from a large hoarding situation in Nevada, and documenting, of course, what that does to them and give us better tools to help them when they're adopted out. Because hoarding, which has gotten a lot of press with all the TV shows about hoarding nowadays, is a horrendous thing for animals to have to experience. So for us to better understand what they go through and how to help them is huge. The other things with cats is working on ways to help cats that are fearful of humans overcome those fears and at least be comfortable with people, if not flat out happy and adoring of people. That's one of the studies that we're working on. And then developing personality and quality of life questionnaires so we can improve the lives of cats wherever they are, in homes, in shelters, all of these things. Once we can measure these things better, we can obviously make better improvements and know we're doing the right thing. So those are all the studies that we have going on with cats.
Well, I'm just really excited about your research. I really am. And how can people stay in touch with your research? Do you have a blog or something? Or
well, not yet. I wish I did. We just haven't set one up yet. They can basically if they do subscribe to our magazine, it carries a lot of that information and our website, just a lot of different sources, but not yet one concise source. I've got to get that together, and I just haven't yet.
Okay. Well, please do, and I hope, I'm sure all the cat lovers would love for you to write another book about how to help cats love people even more than they do.
Yes. So, I'm sure they would, yeah.
Yes. I seem like I always got stuck with scary cats. But once again, I want to tell everybody, Unlocking the Animal Mind, How Your Pet's Feelings Hold the Key to His Health and Happiness, by Dr. Franklin McMillan. And if you want to go over to the Best Friends website, that's bestfriends.org. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and hopefully helping our listeners to make better pet procuring decisions for the holidays.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I enjoyed being on.
Awesome. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak memutuskan berita?